I presume the pressure of my finger is doing something to disturb the crystals so that they're not just operating the polarizer in the same manner. That's a guess on my part. What do you think is happening when I run my finger across my flat screen display? KE2EJ, KQLIW.
KQLIW, KQJ. Well, there's liquid in there. I mean, if you break the thing open, pour it into a glass, and then that liquid is these little crystals. You're actually changing the axis of which they're standing, and you're making a difference in terms of the light passing through it and passing through the polarizer, so you see. And you see, you just tap it. It's sort of like if you just drop something on it, you'll see ripples as though you were looking at a pond. But it's actually liquid in there. And yeah, you're changing the polarization of the material as you disturb it from its natural state, or rather, its current electrically polarized state.
WX2N.
We're going to go back to Paul in a second. I don't think that liquid is now just one continuous sheet of liquid. Otherwise, it'll all just run down to the bottom. My guess is my finger is running across thousands of individual pixels that each contain a capsule with that liquid in it, and my finger is disturbing that. Is that approximately what's happening, Eric?
I don't think of it this way, Dick. You have two sheets of plastic which you've engraved to yourself, and you've made the electrical connections to. You squished your two sandwiches together with the engraved parts looking at each other. But there's a little gap in there, and the liquid actually runs through the whole thing. If you were actually to catch a bubble in there, the bubble would sort of work its way up the top of the screen, so it's not like there's each one little square, individual, closed thing.
Interesting. Okay, the guy who started this all off is Paul, WS2N. Look what you started, Paul. You got it.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I thought that was going to happen with my LCD HDTV. I thought I was going to get that same kind of action, but I did not. I mean, they must have some kind of a protective glass involved with that. I've seen that on the LCD computer displays as well, where you hold your hand and you get that same kind of an effect, but not on the HDTVs, which I'm glad to see. So I just wanted to mention that because you brought that up, Dick. Well, okay, very good. I'm just amazed. I would imagine if you took one of these LED screens, by the way, the size seems to be generally bigger than the LCD HDTVs. It was mostly larger. I was thinking, well, maybe because, you know, it's harder to compress LEDs into a smaller area than the LCDs. But I did find one that was 32-inch. But I know they go as small as that for LED. But you apparently, Eric, in the ones that, yeah, I mean, they're pricey. Some of these are things like $4,000. Apparently, he's saying that they are definitely not individual LEDs, although, you know, I heard comments that there are some displays out there that are. So basically, these things should really be called LED/LCDs, you know, the way when they advertise them in these different stores. I would think that's what they should be doing then, Dick, right?
I agree with you. I would call them LED illuminated LCD screens is what I would call them. So you were jumping the two words together, and you're right. LED/LCD. Again, I had a question and I forgot. I was going to ask Eric. Great displays, though. Where do you see displays going, Eric? I'm hearing something about AMOLED. I think your iPhone these days has a touchscreen AMOLED. I think it means amplitude modulated organic LED display. Combination touchscreen, very bright. Oh, before I go to Eric, the one quick question I want to ask you, Paul. You've now recently gone through some showrooms and you really looked at these things. I can remember a couple of years ago when I looked at some of these big screens, particularly the rear projection types. If you were directly in front of it, it looked okay, but off to one side, it looked pretty yucky. My guess is the modern screens you're seeing today, even though you're off to one side, it still looks pretty good. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah. It was strange. In the store, one of the stores, before I bought one, when I looked down, you know, it was mounted pretty high. I said, that looked terrible. That would be awful. You know? And then a couple of them looked like that. And then some stores, they looked good. But, you know, that really wasn't too much of a factor for me. But then I got mine home. And I was reading the paperwork, and they said up to 172 degrees or something, one way or the other. And it's true. You know, you could go all the way, I mean, right to the side, and I could tell what I'm looking at. I mean, no problem, one way. And then even below it, you know, I mounted mine pretty high. And when I go below it, same thing. No problem. You could lay down on the floor and watch TV. So I'd say they made a big, big difference. I didn't buy a big one. It's only 32, but I didn't buy one of these gigantic things that they sell. I believe in the inverse square law. I don't want my eyes going back and forth all day long, you know, looking left and right. There must be a magic number, by the way. There's got to be a magic number that's most comfortable for the eyes. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Dick. You're just going to have to buy a better lubricant for your eyes and drip it in there, Paul. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm looking at a pictorial diagram of today OLED displays, not OLED lit displays. This is one pixel, which has three pads in it, and it's mounted on one substrate of glass. There is a polarizer and a quarter plate, which is the filter, as compared to an LCD screen, which has a whole bunch of more stuff with it. So, you can say that an OLED TV display, not one that's lit, because the first ones were lit, but what I'm looking at here is one group of three of these per pixel.
Okay. Where do they stand with reference to consumer products? I think you're telling me that a reasonably priced living room television set is not likely today to be very affordable as a pure light-emitting diode-emitting screen, whereas the handheld devices, the AMOLED, I think they are of that type. Is that approximately true, Eric?
Yeah, the OLED OLED per pixel. And they also make a small OLED structure for light projection, actually. So it's very interesting. And by the way, the OLED, where is it? But they do two different material technologies. One is small OLED, which is small molecule. Another one, large molecule. And it was developed by a research group led by Dr. Chang Tang at the Kodak Laboratories in 1987. How's that grab you?
That's the Kodak Laboratories in Rochester, New York. I guess they saw the end coming when it comes to chemical-type photographic film, and they climbed on this bandwagon real soon. Is that what happened, Eric?
I guess so. And the way they're able to get it so small, the deposition of SMLEDs is based on vacuum thermal evaporation. Same sort of thing as we do when we make integrated circuits. So it's polymer-based LEDs based in long polymer organic chains and deposited by SpinCast, the inkjet principle.
You use the word SMLEDs. What does the SM stand for, Paul? I mean, Eric.
Small molecules with, you know, that filled with low molecular weight are called small molecule OLEDs.
Now, I think light emitting liquid crystal displays were quite popular, let me pick a number, 10 years ago on the front cover of some of our digital voltmeters, DVM, digital voltmeter, yes. Portable digital voltmeters for quite a number of years have had liquid crystal displays. When I used to go to the flea market in Deerfield, New Hampshire, or to the one down in Timonium, Maryland, quite often they would be selling you digital voltmeters at very cheap prices that had been put into a low temperature environment by mistake, and the screen was damaged. So I am guessing that there's something about the liquid crystal, at least early displays, that couldn't tolerate the freezing temperatures without experiencing some kind of a permanent damage. What do you know about that subject, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW?
That I had bought some liquid crystal displays. They actually come in, they came in different temperature ranges, so I guess whatever the viscous material that they use has different freezing points, so, and it seems like the ones that go down colder seem a bit more expensive, so I see some difference in formulation, because you, as soon as this thing gets into the first stage of icing, that's the worst possible place you can be, because it expands, you know, beyond its volume, and then, of course, as it gets colder, it shrinks down much. That's why when you throw a glass bottle in a freezer, it breaks. That, you know, it takes up so much volume as liquid, and when it finally gets to a final freezing temperature, it takes up the same volume, but in between, it gets bigger.
Okay, now here's a science question I'm throwing out to the whole crew that's present here. Something I'd like to know about. Thank goodness water expands when it freezes. That means ice floats on top of a pond of water. Therefore, hibernating animals below the surface can survive. An awful lot of life on Earth is here because water has this magic property. It expands when it goes below 4 degrees centigrade. Therefore, ice floats and water does not. Now, when water molecules become frozen, they become a crystal lattice. Each of the individual water molecules are now essentially locked in place. And temperature of that ice is a function of how much they are vibrating. Temperature is average kinetic energy of your molecules of the substance. That's what temperature really is. So a cold ice cube and a colder ice cube has a different amount of shake in place of these individual molecules that are locked into this crystal lattice. I got a vague understanding that the H2O, there's two hydrogens and one oxygen molecule. The two hydrogens marry themselves to an oxygen molecule at some kind of a crazy angle, like 112 degrees apart. I have the impression that at different temperatures, that angle changes, and by some mechanism that I do not yet understand, the spacing between the individual molecules of the crystal lattice of the ice expands when temperature is lowered. It's an opposite of normal. Most substances have positive temperature coefficients of expansion. Higher temperature, greater volume. Water does that above 4 degrees centigrade. Below 4 degrees centigrade, water turns around and does the opposite. The colder it is, the more it expands. Can somebody explain at the molecular level what is going on there? Give me a call, letters right now. KQLIW in the TechNet. Well, and I thought we had some good scientists here. That's left to the student as an exercise. Explain to me why water expands when it gets colder. I'd like to know a little bit more about what does that. And another thing I want to know about is that when you heat up ice, and it becomes eventually the molecules move so violently that they break away from that crystal lattice. They're no longer locked in place. They become a fluid. So water is a fluid. When you boil water so that the water now becomes a gas, gas is also a fluid. And the gas, the water vapor, the fluid, has about 1,500 times or something like that more volume, more spacing between the molecules than the liquid. What happened to the individual molecules of the fluid when it went from the liquid state to the gaseous state? Why do they suddenly decide to adjust themselves to a different distance? Can anybody explain that one to me? K2LIW. My goodness, the silence is deafening. Okay. You guys are going to think about that. You're eventually going to come back. I think Andy was the next guy that, if he's available, has an antenna question for us. Andy, WA2CDL, if you're there. If not, we'll carry on without you. But if you're there, you can more formally pose your question to the group. we had a little bit of a pre-question period between Andy and I a couple of days ago. The A2CDL, one of the guys who runs this repeater, KQRIW. Okay. Andy called up the M Squared company, which is that Mike Stoll, I think it is. I think that's his name. I once knew his call at a W6 something or other. Somebody will tell me that pretty soon.
T6MYC.
K6MYC, Mike Stoll, okay. Who used to run, now runs the M Squared company. What was the name of his previous company, Rich?
Oh, I'm trying to think. Was that KLM Antenna?
I think you're right. I think it was KLM. So KLM became M Squared, and it's Mike Stoll, K6MYC. Andy called up Mike Stahl's engineer and asked a couple of questions about stacking antennas. And this is a reasonably controversial area. You can read lots and lots of individual articles that people have written about what is the proper stacking distance of individual Yagis. Glenn brought to my attention this week a beautiful article written by a guy in Australia. And my guess is Glenn can probably ship you a copy of it if you ask him real nice, KC2QIQ. Very well written article. We can tell you what the URL is. Anyhow, the guy is telling the pros and cons of increasing the gain of an already big Yagi. Let's assume you're a pretty serious 2-meter guy. You've got a Yagi that's 20 feet long. You've got a certain amount of gain. You're reasonably happy with it, but now you'd like to have more gain. Your choices are to add more Yagi by either vertical stacking, horizontal stacking, or both, or go out and buy a longer Yagi, buy a 40-foot long Yagi instead of a 20-foot long Yagi. And what are the pros and cons? Well, after describing all the individual characteristics of those antennas, the good news is that the 40-foot long antenna has one very nice, simple pattern that's very predictable. And when you vertically stack individual Yagis, you don't take up as much real estate of antenna that overhangs your property and overhangs the neighbor's house and maybe makes them unhappy, and also that much longer antenna, if you're not smart enough to do any wind balancing, you can grind up a rotator real fast. So there's some distinct disadvantages of putting up a 40-foot long antenna and putting up a pair of 20s to get you the same amount of gain increase, but nowhere near as much drastic wind load as far as moment of inertia is concerned. Twist capability of the wind blowing on your antenna, grinding into your rotator. So each strongly favors stacking. When you vertically stack, you end up with a vertical pattern that's very narrow, but the horizontal pattern stays the same. But everybody will be free to be louder. And most people will, if they have the resources, will vertically stack. Well, the 20-foot long boom Yagis with vertical stacking might require 15 foot of stacking distance. And unless you've got a pretty strong mast, that can easily be broken in the wind. Horizontal stacking is a repeater.
Time out.
Mechanically speaking, horizontal stacking is a little bit friendlier. However, when you horizontally stack, your horizontal beam width goes down to a smaller fraction of what it was before, and you develop some pretty strong side lobes, so-called grating lobes. And that's the laws of physics of interferometry, of making a phased array of individual Yagi antennas. It's not a fault of the antenna itself that when you horizontally stack at reasonable distances, quite often that very first side lobe is only 11 or 12 dB down, and it's supposed to be there at a reasonable stacking distance. Stack them closer, and that side lobe gets weaker, but you don't get as much gain increase. You're starting to overlap the area. So one criteria for choosing the stacking distance is overlapping area. Now, one of the things that, with my suggestion, John Fandle, WA2FDJ, I'm having trouble remembering John Fandle's call letters. He used to live in Levittown, and he set up a pretty large bed spring that holds his moon-bound antenna on top of the roof of his house. It consisted of four Yagis on 2 meters in the four corners, and then eight Yagis on 432 in between. And lots of people were telling him now that's never going to work because of the 3-to-1 frequency relationship between the 432 Yagis and the 2-meter Yagis. Lots of people told him it's going to interfere. One's going to cancel the other, and it's going to be a big mishmash, a big wind load, and it's going to electronically not work. Well, at my suggestion, John built the antenna, And the bottom line is he was extremely happy with it. He was doing moon bounce on 2 meters. He's doing moon bounce on 432 with one single bed spring with antennas on both bands interstitially diffused between. And so the next question Andy had asked the guys at M Squared was, can I stack 432 Yagis in between the 2 meter Yagis? He was told no. And the reason given is logical sounding, but I think it's an error. The logical sounding reason is that when you're on 432, the 2 meter antenna elements are going to be seeing the 432 energy, which is the third harmonic. They're going to respond to it. Therefore, the pattern is going to be wrong. The gain is going to be lowered. The side lobe is going to come up. It's going to crash and burn. All kinds of bad things are going to happen. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's essentially what Andy was told.
Repeater, time out.
Based on the John Fandel experience, that is not true. And there's a very simple explanation for why it's not true. First of all, when it comes to stacking antennas, the proper stacking distance is to first recognize that a long Yagi has an effective capture area that is essentially a circle that is slightly elliptical. A horizontally polarized Yagi has a little bit more width and height to its elliptical effective capture area. The effective capture area, radio-wise, is a hell of a lot bigger than what your eye sees. To give you an example, an antenna that I'm familiar with, the RIW 19 Yagi, 19 elements, 13-foot long boom on 432 megacycles. Each individual element is approximately 12 inches, approximately 1 foot long. You look down the boom of that antenna with your eye, you see a 1-inch diameter piece of tubing that is the boom, and you see a whole bunch of elements that are all roughly 1 foot long. Look at it so that it lines up correctly. They're all behind each other. You see one single 12-foot long element, 12-inch long element, 1 foot long element, and this 1-inch diameter circle of aluminum called boom. Radio-wise, that is a 5.7-foot diameter circle, even though it's made up of elements that are only 1 foot long. If your eyes operated at 432, you stood off at a distance and looked down that Yagi, you would see a black circle in space, 5.7 feet in diameter. All the energy on 432 coming down in that direction to that circle gets sucked up by that black area, 5.7 feet in diameter. All gets focused down to the driven element, goes down the feed line, and moves your rest meter of the receiver. That's the way the Yagi works. It has that kind of a focusing action. That's the way in-fire antennas work. And the magic of all the string of directors that does all that is that each of those directors is a dipole-like object. Let me drop. Each of those dipole-like objects are tuned a little bit higher than resonant frequency. It's a little bit shorter than resonant frequency. Therefore, they have a capacitive reactance. A signal coming from free space, a flat signal coming into your antenna area, hits that string of directors. The string of directors is a synthesized dielectric material. It's a slow wave structure. The velocity of propagation of that free space wave in the vicinity of the boom of that Yagi, in the vicinity of those directors, that wave moves more slowly. Because the wave moves more slowly close to the boom and a little bit faster outside of the area near the boom, you get a folding action. By Huygens' principle, the signal, you're developing a little bit of a void because of the slowness that you're creating, and signal from the side starts folding in. And so, like a magnifying glass, you're gathering a great big area, 5.7 feet in diameter, focusing all that energy down to the driven element, which sucks it up and sends it down to the feed line if that driven element is properly impedance matched. Now, what's required for that director string to do that? That director string consists of a significant number of parasitic elements, you and I call them directors, that are all tuned a little bit shorter than resonance. That makes them capacitive. That makes them a slow wave structure. But in a modern, high-performance Yagi, they are not all tuned the same. In the old days, we used to taper them a little bit shorter in the way up front, a little bit longer close to the driven element, in order to give them expanded bandwidth, frequency bandwidth. Nowadays, we use something much more exotic than a simple taper. The taper sometimes has reversals to it, in which if you look at the length of the individual directors, they're modulated in a particular way. They do tend to get a little bit shorter near the front. but sometimes if you look at it very carefully, it's got a Coke bottle shape. Therefore, what you're really doing is you're setting the near area slow wave phenomena by adjusting the length of those individual directors and by adjusting those positions so that the bottom line of the positions and length of those directors, when properly tuned, gives you not only a slow wave structure, but it gives you a slow wave structure which has a velocity profile along the boom. The velocity of propagation of the signal along that boom is different in the vicinity of the area close to the driven element as opposed to the middle of the Yagi, as opposed to the forward tip of the Yagi. You have different velocity factors, and when you plot that as a graph, it is called a velocity profile. When you maximize the gain of a Yagi at a particular frequency, you're generating a particular velocity profile. That's the magic that makes a Yagi work. That's what your Yagi optimization and your NEC programs and whatever are doing. They're calculating what each individual director is doing. They're calculating the velocity profile. They're calculating what happens to the Huygens principle, the folding of the wave, and ultimately, what is your effective capture area, what is your gain, what is your pattern, and so on. So for the Yagi to work well, all of those directors are each one individually tuned to the right resonant frequency, each one located at a particular position in three-dimensional space. You will have the right length, the right positions, of the right number of parasitic elements to give you a high-performance Yagi. Now, what happens if I take that 2-meter Yagi and I feed energy into the driven element?
Repeater, timeout.
I take that 2-meter Yagi and I feed energy into the driven element at 432. I can easily do that. If I'm smart enough, I can put an impedance matching network on that driven element, and I can make the driven element absorb all of the energy from my transmission line that I give it on 432, even though the antenna originally was designed for 2 meters. A naive person would say, okay, the driven element is operating on a third harmonic. All of those directors are running on their third harmonic. It should fly like a charm. Good sounding theory on paper. Dead wrong. You put 432 energy into a 2-meter Yagi and measure its gain and measure its pattern, you'll find out it's got approximately the gain of a single dipole. A little bit more, but not much. All of that focusing action, that velocity profile, is not there. There's, by 3-to-1 ratio, there's nowhere near enough directors for 432. The directors are there, are tuned to the wrong frequency. They're in the wrong position, there's not enough of them, and they're tuned to the wrong frequency. Other than that, they're pretty good. You can force the driven element to accept your energy. The rest of the directors are not going to give you very much action. They got the wrong velocity profile. The bottom line of all that is that on 432, that 2-meter Yagi has almost no gain. As a receiving device, it has almost no effective capture area. Therefore, when you've got nearby 432 Yagis that are trying to excite your 2-meter antenna, the amount of excitation it gives it is minor, the amount of change in the pattern is minor, the amount of decrease in your performance of the 432 Yagis is minor, very tolerable. And if you're smart enough, the little bit of detriment it creates, you can tune that out too. So, once you realize what's going on here, you stack the individual 2-meter Yagis at the right spacing so that their original effective capture areas don't overlap too much, and you get all the gain increase of stacking those Yagis. Let me drop. On 432, you make each of your 432 Yagis the right stacking distance. A super conservative person will say, my 2-meter Yagi has got this much area, my 432 Yagi has got that much area, therefore I add those two together as circles side by side, a big circle and a small circle, and I don't put them any closer together than that. Super, super conservative, wasteful of antenna space on your mast, you don't have to do that. For the most part, the 2-meter Yagi does not see the 432, and for sure, the 432, I got it right now, the 2-meter Yagi does not even see the slightest inkling of the 432 Yagi. The 432 Yagi sees a little bit of action out of 2-meter Yagi, but it's so small that you could easily stop it from happening if you wanted to. And if you ignored it, it's not much of a problem. So when you're making a bed spring, a great big support structure for all of your antennas on this great big moon bounce, in the old days, before you had Joe Taylor programs,
weak signal JT, WSJT program, the programs which will allow you with one single long 2-meter Yagi do moon bounce. In the old days, you used to have a great big array. Let me drop. Good moon bounce in the old days required something in the vicinity of 400 square feet of antenna, a healthy 1,000 watts of power supplied to that antenna, and a noise figure of approximately half a dB on the preamplifier, also connected to that antenna. You put that combination together, 400 square feet on 432, something close to 30 decibels of gain, 1,000 watts of power on transmit, 400 square feet of effective capture area on reception, half a dB noise figure, and you're going to hear your echoes off the moon. That's what was required in the old days. Nowadays, with these computer programs that can suck extremely weak, carefully tailored signals out of the noise, one single Yagi can do that, one very well-tuned Yagi. So life has changed an awful lot, but still, if you're putting up a great big antenna array, a smart guy realizes that moon bounce is fun. It allows you to talk to anyone on planet Earth that is able to see the moon at the same time you can. That's the good news. The bad news, that signal off the moon is so darn weak that under good conditions you can, without much extra threshold, recognize the call letters and the one piece of information he's sending you, an S1 signal report, so to speak, an OO or an MM signal report. And therefore, it's an official contact, but it's not a rag-chewer mode. Right now, you guys and I am rag-chewing. Well, I'm the rag-chewer. But we're passing information back and forth. We're really human interface is taking place. We're communicating. Moon bounce is not really a communicator mode. Yes, you send QSL cards, you rack up states, you rack up countries, you rack up distances. And for a certain kind of competitive spirit, that's a fun thing to do for a certain period of time. Talk to the guys who have done moon bounce. Only a small percentage of them have done it for a good fraction of a lifetime. Whereas you take real communication when people are talking to each other, comparing ideas. Like, for instance, this particular technical net is now going on its 27th year. In September, it will be its 27th year. In theory, we are trying to communicate with each other. You try to find a guy who has done moon bounce for 27 years, steady, and enjoyed it, and that's a rare individual. They're extremely rare. That's not even one per million, if you ask me. As such, moon bounce is something to do along with other kinds of ham radio. To do it exclusively, I think you might not. It's challenging, without a doubt, but because you're sort of living alone and not really communicating and comparing ideas with people on the medium itself, it lacks some of the pleasure that the other 26 kinds of ham radio can give you. That's a bunch of opinions, but at least I'm telling you where the opinions have come from, and you can decide to agree or disagree. But the bottom line of all this is stacking antennas is a hell of a lot more friendly than people knew about, in my opinion. Now, you talk to many antenna manufacturers, you hit them with the information I just gave you, and they'll say it's dead wrong. This is not what we recommend. This is not what we tell our people to do. Well, have they tried it? That's the question to ask them. Have they tried it? They're saying that the two are going to interfere with each other. Well, yeah. The Telerex company in New Jersey used to tell people that you have to make sure that your guy wires don't hit resonance, otherwise your antenna pattern is going to be disturbed. Well, everything can disturb my antenna pattern. If I put my hand up in the air and I stand on the bottom of the tower, I'm disturbing the antenna pattern. But how much? Are you changing the gain of the forward lobe of the antenna because of the resonance of the guy wire by a tenth of a dB? Is the front-to-back ratio changing by 1 dB? Can I tolerate that? And to say that it's making a change, that's a given. But magnitude makes the big difference. Is it significant? Should I worry about it? Should I go through all the rigmarole of putting zillions of egg insulators along my guy wires to make sure that they don't resonate? There's a huge disadvantage of doing that. It drastically lowers the reliability of your guy wires because you've got a whole lot of hardware now. Any one of those pieces of hardware fail, and the tower falls over. A guy wire is no stronger than it's like a chain, no stronger than the weakest link. So I'm strongly not in favor of insulated guy wires and putting lots of egg insulators all over the place. If your guy wire just happens to hit resonance,
Repeater, time out.
There's a zillion ways of killing that resonant. Just put a capacitive top hat somewhere in the middle of the guy wire. Grab a piece of sheet metal and mount it on the guy wire in a critical place, and I can kill that resonant. Put a piece of guy wire mounted at right angles, connected to your guy wire, and connect it over to the tower or whatever you want to. There's a lot of ways I can kill that resonant. I don't have to break it up with a zillion insulators. That's an opinion. Anybody got any opinions, any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW.
KC2FYJ.
FEY. FYJ and KEY in that order. Mr. FYJ, I know your name. Please tell me again.
It's Harry, Dick, and my comment pertains back to your question about water a while back, so finish with the antenna stuff and then come back to me.
I'm back to you right now, Harry. Please tell me about water. What is the mechanism at the molecular level by which those molecules decide to separate themselves at a greater distance with this huge force that will burst a Schedule 40 pipe? How the hell does water do that? Over to you, Harry.
Okay, well, first of all, I am referring to a web page that I found, and I will give you the URL. It's www.physicalgeography.net/fundamentals/8a.html, the 8a referring to Chapter 8, Section A. www.physicalgeography.net/fundamentals/8a, the digit 8a.html. And basically, what happens is this. The molecular structure of a water molecule is two hydrogens and one oxygen. The hydrogens are at an angle, as you indicated, of somewhere around 112 or 120 degrees, more or less. It's exact. It doesn't shift about. I just don't remember the exact angle. This has the effect of putting a slight positive charge on one side of an oxygen molecule and a slight negative charge on the side opposite where the two hydrogen atoms are. As a result, a molecule of water will have a tendency to clump against another molecule of water, similar to the way magnets do. It's not a hugely strong bond, but it's an electrical connection nonetheless. When water is in the gaseous state, it has sufficient energy per molecule that none of those little bonds will hold in place. I'm going to let it drop a second. Or very few of them, anyway. When it goes, and that's a random molecular structure of vaporized water. When it goes into the liquid state, there's not as much energy, and so those molecules will begin to clump together in little clumps of molecules that are maybe two or three or four molecules long as little chains of water. Hydrogen on one side, nothing on the other, bonding to the hydrogen on one side with nothing on the other, etc. And those little clumps can move around and slide amongst each other. However, when water goes into the frozen state, that bonding rearranges itself. And what happens is that the an individual hydrogen atom from one molecule will attach itself to the negative side of another molecule instead of the negative side of a water molecule fitting in between the two hydrogen atoms. One of the hydrogen atoms will attach to the far end of the water molecule, and what you wind up with is a sort of a ring pattern. It looks a lot like the hexagon tiles in the bathroom, where the vertices are where the oxygen molecules are, and the hydrogen molecules are along each of the sides. And as a result of that rearrangement, the water will actually expand to about 9% increase in volume with the compensating decrease in density.
Wild stuff. Interesting. Going to go to their website, study it. Sounds like you found it. Glad to hear that one. Henry, I think it is. Great.
Harry.
Harry. Oh, boy. Quite terrible. Thank you, Harry. Looks like you found a good explanation. Wild that it does that. And the fact that a water molecule is a kind of a dipole molecule, it's got a positive on one side and a negative on the other side, means that when that water molecule is in your microwave oven, that water molecule is spinning back and forth in place, trying to align itself with each half cycle of that microwave signal, the 2.4 gigahertz signal, 2.45 gigahertz signal, that the magnetron is pouring into that cavity that contains your food, that contains the water molecule. And the water molecule is trying to keep up with that signal, but it doesn't do it. It's got a hysteresis lag, and that's the mechanism of loss. That's why the water gets hot in that microwave oven. Most of the cooking in your microwave oven is the water doing the cooking. Put a very, very dry piece of bread in there with a glass of water. The water will get hot. The piece of bread will not heat up at all. So it isn't just mass that heats in the microwave oven. Primarily, it's water-like substances. Great stuff. Mel, K2KEY?
There's a bit more I can tell you if you're interested.
Hey, we're all ears. We're scientists here. Go for it, Harry.
Well, this website has a few other very interesting bits and pieces of characteristics of water. One is kind of frightening, and that is that if all of the ice on the planet were to melt, sea level would rise by about 70 meters. Not 7, 70. Which is a huge, huge rise, which gives you an idea of just how much water is trapped in the ice. And another point that it makes is that water is the only molecule that exists in its natural form on this planet in all three states, vapor, liquid, and solid. There's no other material that can exist in all three states on the surface of the Earth other than in laboratory conditions. It'll exist in one or two, but not all three. There's also a table that indicates the density of water molecules at various temperatures. Water, fresh water, is at its densest at 4 degrees Celsius. And at 0 degrees Celsius in its liquid state, it's 0.999 grams per cubic centimeter. At 0 degrees Celsius in a solid state, it's 0.915 grams per cubic centimeter. And as a gas, it's 0.0006 grams per cubic centimeter. At 80 degrees Celsius, it's still at 0.9718 grams per cubic meter. So when it goes from gas, from liquid to gas, it suddenly and very rapidly decreases in its density.
KC2, QAQ. Great stuff. I'm going to start drinking water. Go ahead, Glenn.
I think there was a very interesting part that he added there right in the middle. Water is water is water, whether it's a gas, whether it's a liquid, or whether it's a solid. The energy state definitely increases as temperature goes up, and it will eventually expand into a gas. As it starts to freeze, it becomes more and more dense, and it gets the molecules at the molecular level. It's still water, still H2O. It may reposition itself so that the molecules get a lot closer and closer together. But keep in mind, in most water that we know of here on Earth, whether it's in a glass, in the ocean, it's not completely pure. There's other things. There's a compound mixed in with it. You got some nitrogen in there, some oxygen floating around in between so the fish can breathe. You have sodium. You got all kinds of things mixed in with that water. As you start getting into the freezing state, what will happen is, as it starts going towards a solid, many of those other items, some of them are going to distill and wind up in the water below it. And what will happen is some get trapped in between. And as you start going into the crystalline state, those other items are going to be suspended in between the water molecules as they go into a solid and they go into that crystalline shape. Because those other items are trapped inside as it goes into the crystalline state, they're going to start pushing and pushing further apart to separate the difference between the water molecules and the other molecules. that difference in energy outside of the molecular level. So it's really expanding the ice quite a bit and adds to the expansion power of ice. KC2QIQ.
What a good science class we got going here today. Okay, Glenn and Harry, here's the question for you. When I've got an ice cube, a bunch of them crushed sitting in a bucket, and I pour salt in there, the ice gets a lot colder. It gets a lot colder than normal, and it starts melting. Anybody got a simple explanation for why salt will do that?
Yeah, basically because they're, as I said, the water is still water, the salt is still the salt. So what basically is happening is their melting temperatures are different, and it will actually change the point at which the water is going to go from, you know, it's basically pure water, will go from, you know, water to ice, 0 degrees C. As you start putting salt inside there, the temperature is going to, the melting point temperature is going to change because of the mix of the compound, the impurity in the compound. KC2QIQ.
You know, Harry, you said that water is the one substance that has a triple state at the temperatures and pressures on planet Earth. I think there's actually a quadruple state. I can take water vapor, like happens in a rainstorm, lightning passes through it. Where the lightning bolt has hit the water vapor, I've now got plasma. I've yanked some of those electrons and away from the individual molecules. I'm not quite sure whether or not there is a clear plasma state for water vapor like there is for air, but I think there very might well be. So when you include lightning, I think all four possible states of water can at least for a short period of time exist on planet Earth. KQLIW.
Good point. I don't think this book was taking that particular state of matter into consideration, however. I also raised the interesting question, is steam yet another state, or is it something else?
I was having a discussion with a buddy of mine who's pretty good on chemistry, and he understands the laws of thermodynamics, that in every ordinary thermodynamic situation, without a whole lot of outside intervention, energy always runs downhill. That rock will roll down the hill, give up some heat sliding on the hill, and you heat up the rock, it ain't going to climb back up the hill. It goes in one direction. However, when water as a liquid slowly evaporates into water as a vapor, and it takes 540 calories of heat of vaporization to do that, you get some cooling in the process, but a mole of water becoming a mole of water vapor has a higher energy state. That higher energy state is uphill. In the process of evaporation, at first, to a naive person, it looks like a violation of one of the laws of thermodynamics. The energy is going uphill instead of downhill. KQLIW.
Okay, dude.
Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I found an interesting blurb on the web. And they call it the anomalous properties of water. Water has been known to exhibit many physical properties that distinguish it from other small molecules of comparable mass. Chemists refer to these anomalous properties of water. They are by no means mysterious. They are all entirely predictable consequences of the way the size and nuclear charge of oxygen atoms conspire to distort the electric charged clouds of the atoms of other elements when these are chemically bonded to oxygen. And they go on, blah, 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 and they say that water is one of the few known substances in its solid form is less dense than liquid. They give you a plot, and they show you where the discontinuity of the phase transition between water and ice is. They say the large increase, which is about 9% on freezing, shows why ice floats and why pipes burst. The expansion between minus 4 and 0 is due to the formation of larger hydrogen-bonded aggregates. Above 4 degrees of thermal expansion sets in as vibrations of the OH bonds become more vigorous, tending to shove the molecules further apart. Then they go on to explain why the boiling point doesn't make sense with every other known piece of material. But interesting clip.
Yeah, when you get a chance, you're going to have to tell us that URL. Where Harry told us that if all the ice on planet Earth melted, our sea level would rise by 70 meters. That's around 290 feet. My piece of land is 300 feet above sea level. I would barely survive. I think almost all of Manhattan would be underwater for the first 20 or 30 floors of each of those buildings. Harry, if you lived in Manhattan, I think you'd be able to climb to a high enough building fast enough if that happened. And by the way, we've often worried about, you know, if it rains for 40 days and 40 nights, where's all the water coming from? If I take the current sea level and raise it by 70 meters, interesting question is, what percentage of the current landmass on planet Earth would be above water? I'm not convinced it would be a very big percentage. There wouldn't be very many places to dwell. Where would you go, Harry? KC2FYJ, K2RIW.
I'd do what Noah did and get in a boat.
Okay, as long as you get enough forewarning to build the boat. Would you put a bunch of animals on the boat with you, Harry?
I don't know. I might have to depend on fish.
Okay, so that's where the food's going to come from. You're going to do a whole lot of fishing. You're going to bring your fishing rods and a bunch of bait and fish off the side of the boat and hope that all the animals find the Himalayas and all the other good mountain ranges to dwell until things calm down. So, there have been some pretty big thermal cycles on planet Earth over the last 4.5 billion years. And some of those cycles, I guess, have done some pretty big melting of the ice. Although, right now, the guys who study ice by digging into it and going down X number of feet, which goes back a certain number of years, and looking at the trapped air and water molecules and looking at the contaminants they contain, they can rather nicely find out what was the temperature like, what was the solar constant like. There's an awful lot of history buried in our ice, which allows you to go back a whole lot of years. I know that way back quite a few minutes ago, Mel, K2KEY, was going to say something. Mel, go right ahead. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. This is K2KEY. Well, we were on the subject of stacking antennas, so... are we finished with that? Because I was going to make a couple of comments over.
We're very adaptive people. We flip back and forth on subjects. Nobody is setting the rules that we've got to stay on this subject forever. You got it, Mel.
Okay, no, I don't mind. It's just as long as you don't mind going back to Yaggies again. You were talking about years ago, these companies, you mentioned Telrex, Mosley, and a few others. Now, they were selling, at that time, monoband HF antennas were their big business at that time. And I remember distinctly that they said, both of them came out basically with the same story, that they'd rather have 2 3-element stack beams than 1 6-element antenna. And the reason... they said that, if I'm not mistaken, maybe I'll say it wrong, but I'll try, that on long paths, long isospheric paths, the stack pair will show at least 2 to 3 dB gain over what would be if it was just a straight, you know, like say 6 elements versus 2 stack 3. And, Is there any truth to this, Dick? Did you ever look into this? Because they said that stacking it would lower the radiation results for long paths. Over.
I see the possibility of this being one of those urban legends that people believed it, and it's a hard thing to check, and therefore very few people challenged it. I can take 2 individual Yagis that have a certain amount of area. I can decide to stack those two antennas so that the areas add, or I can build a Yagi of twice the length, and for a rough approximation, I get twice the area. In both cases, I get 3 dB of gain, but it's distributed a little bit differently. The one long Yagi gives me a kind of a cucumber in space where the horizontal and vertical beamwidths are close to each other. The vertical stacking of two individual Yagis gives me that extra area, but because of the physical arrangement of those areas, I'm going to be more than twice as narrow vertically than horizontally. Now, when a signal bounces off the ionosphere, and I'm doing really long path DX, I'm having difficulty believing that that signal could arrive at my antenna at anything very far off of that horizon. I want to graze the Earth and go out there as far as I can before I make the first bounce off that ionosphere. Yes, I could be occasionally seeing a signal at a higher angle just because of the way it bounces to get to me. But what is that higher angle? 5, 10, 15 degrees above the horizon? I'm having trouble believing that for real serious long-range DX, it is anything more than that kind of an angle above the horizon. And with that vertical stacking of three element Yagis, I might have a vertical beamwidth that is 50 degrees, and the signals that I care about rarely get more than 5 or 10 degrees above that horizon. So, I'm having trouble believing that a stacked array versus a long Yagi of equal gain as the combination are going to have a significant difference in performance. I'm listening now to, I'm thinking about ground noise, I'm thinking about sky noise, I'm thinking about vertical and horizontal beamwidth. I mean, how much signal you get when you're receiving is primarily a function of what amount of radio area is that antenna presenting to the angle of arrival and the polarization of arrived repeaters.
Time out.
And the polarization of arrival of that signal. Now, one of the things that's frequently ignored is Faraday rotation. But the vast majority of our HF signals, as they go through that plasma called ionosphere, which has got a mixed magnetic field from the Earth into it, are experiencing non-reciprocal kinds of rotation of polarization. I can easily launch a signal on Long Island that is horizontally polarized. It may twist 7 times before it gets to England and arrives vertically polarized. I think a wave on 40 meters could do that. So I don't see a polarization difference between a long Yagi and a stacked pair. I see a lot of advantage of setting up some horizontal and vertical elements or making a great big X out of them. One set of elements on the boom slanted 45 degrees to the right, one set of elements 45 degrees to the left, two separate driven elements, and I flip back and forth electronically between them, and some of those QSB phase that I experience but are really Faraday rotation, I can recover them. So there's a lot of these characteristics that I don't think Moseley and Telrex, by modern standards, explored as much as they could have. That's a bunch of opinions. Let's see where you stand on all this stuff. On K2KEY, and did they give an explanation? K2RIW.
Well, the only explanation, of course, they gave you that that method of stacking because of the lower angle of takeoff that it created would give you, in other words, I could say to London, England from your QTH, the one less skip required or something to that effect. But I've never had the facilities nor the financial end of this type of experiment to be able to conduct them here. Of course, they have said they have conducted these experiments with their antenna systems, and they use it as a gospel. Okay? And in fact, another one that comes to mind that they said the optimum spacing for Yagis with booms that are at least one wavelength long is a spacing of one wavelength, Dick. What do you think about that, over?
It's a rule of thumb. There are people who use stacking distances of boom length, square root of boom length, all kinds of combinations, and a constant multiplied by the square root. As I see it, the right way to do it is to take your antenna